when we have these opportunities to do multiple services. We're able to practice that interoperability.
By air, sea, and land, Alaska's military is gearing up for its largest training exercise of the year. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the future of a progressive Alaska website is uncertain after losing its driving force.
I have spent 5 years fighting the charge that I'm not legitimate.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Police in Anchorage say they've determined that a single person was responsible for a wave of killings over the summer. In a statement today, the department says homicide detectives have sufficient probable cause to conclude James Dale Ritchie murdered five people picked largely at random with the same gun. Ritchie died during an early morning shootout with an APD officer in November after a routine stop on a downtown street. APD says Ritchie is suspected in the homicides because of his ownership of a Colt 357 Python revolver used in all five murders. Both the APD and FBI refused to comment further today on the case. Neither agency will say whether Ritchie is thought to have committed other homicides, specifically how they reached the conclusion that he committed all five homicides, and whether there will be any follow-up. In a statement, APD spokesperson Renee Oystad says APD and the FBI do not want to discuss or compromise their investigative techniques. The investigation involved multiple law enforcement agencies as well as a huge effort to gather information from the public. For months, police and elected officials in Anchorage declined to say whether a rash of random overnight killings were connected. Two victims were found by a trail near Post Road. One young man was shot riding his bike on the east side of town. And in August, another two victims were discovered near one another on a popular stretch of trail in Valley of the Moon Park. Alaska Governor Bill Walker is trying to force legislators to consider his appointments to boards, commissions, and key administration posts. This comes after Alaska Senate refused House requests to meet in joint session to consider confirmations. Walker issued a proclamation today calling the legislature into joint session tomorrow. He cites two constitutional provisions as giving him authority to do so. One allows a governor to convene the legislature whenever he deems it in the public interest. The other cites the governor's responsibility for the faithful execution of the laws. Senate Rules Committee Chair Kevin Meyer says the Senate majority planned to meet to discuss the proclamation. Senate Majority Leader Peter Michicki previously said delaying a confirmation session would allow lawmakers to focus on completing work on key legislation. The prospect of having a state income tax in Alaska for the first time in 37 years drew passionate responses both in favor and opposed during public testimony on Tuesday. Most of the more than 100 people who offered testimony to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee supported House Bill 115. The legislature would close a quarter of the gap between what the state government spends and what it raises. Juneau resident Julie Nielsen says while she doesn't have children, she's concerned about proposed cuts on education and social services.
I think that the income tax is good because it's the least regressive option. I think that the proposed Senate cuts go too far because they might cut government to the point that it's not as effective.
Matanuska Susitna Borough resident Matt Steele opposes the tax. He says he'd like to see the legislature cut the budget more.
This income tax is going to be devastating to my business and the business of most small business owners that I know. It is insane.
The House majority seeks to tie the income tax and increases to oil and gas taxes to a bill that would limit permanent fund dividends. That measure also would draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. The Senate majority says it wants to cut spending instead of adding taxes, but it isn't saying where cuts in future years would fall. The skies above the interior and south central Alaska will get a lot busier starting next week when Northern Edge 2017 gets underway. As KYC's Tim Ellis reports, it's the biggest military training exercise to be held this year in Alaska.
The tempo of operations around Eielson Air Force Base, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and the state's training ranges will pick up Monday and last through May 12th. But Alaskan Command spokeswoman Captain Anastasia Schmidt says Northern Edge training exercises will be conducted only on weekdays this year.
We will not be exercising on the weekends, however.
Schmidt says some 6,000 personnel and about 180 aircraft from all the armed services will participate in this year's exercise, which she says will be a bit smaller in scale than the 2015 iteration. She says the whole point of joint exercises that involve two or more services like Northern Edge is to provide training that enables people and equipment to work together.
When we have these opportunities to do multiple services, we're able to practice that interoperability and make sure that, you know, when we do have to go into a real-world operation, we're able to talk to each other, all of our equipment works well together, simple things like that.
The airspace over the Gulf of Alaska also will be busier during Northern Edge, as Navy and Marine aircraft conduct training in conjunction with vessels that'll be operating in the Gulf.
There's going to be two naval destroyers and one replenishment ship.
Personnel and equipment from the Coast Guard and Reserve and National Guard units also will participate. Northern Edge is one of a series of exercises conducted by the U.S. Pacific Command, which is headquartered in Hawaii and which operates throughout the Indo-Asia-Pacific region. Schmidt says residents who want to report excessive aircraft noise can call the Alaskan Command's toll-free complaint line. That's 1-800-JET-NOISE. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A hatchery in a small southeast Alaska community that closed down under a mountain of debt in 2014 has been purchased by a nonprofit organization that plans to produce chum and Chinook salmon at the site. The state foreclosed on the Gunnock Creek Hatchery's $22 million debt and put it up for sale. The Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association bought the facility in Cake for an undisclosed price this month. Fred Parody with the state's Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development says the regional group was the only bidder on the property formerly owned by the Cake Nonprofit Fisheries Corporation. The Aquaculture Association's general manager, Steve Reifenstuhl, says the group will invest $2.5 million in the hatchery before things are up and running. An influential website in Alaska lost its driving force earlier this week. For several years, Alaska Commons has brought news and commentary with a left-leaning perspective to tens of thousands of readers. With the departure of its managing editor, the group's future remains unclear, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
John Arano started writing online about Anchorage politics more than a decade ago. After a stint working for a member of the city's assembly, he founded Alaska Commons in its current iteration, along with a group of friends, just over 5 years ago.
I guess we were just annoyed with the fact that a lot of stories that we saw that we thought mattered, we didn't see getting covered.
Arano, whose earlier career included a stint as a touring rock musician, threw himself into the role of managing editor. The site has won plenty of journalism awards over the years, covering a mix of Anchorage and state politics, as well as original reporting on progressive issues, commentary and analysis, and a whimsical weekly roundup of internet memes, sort of like a cross between an alt-weekly and a wonky politics blog. It kept growing, and Arano says drew a monthly readership of 20 to 30,000 people.
You know, we've had some articles that have over 1 million views.
But maintaining a steady flow of content wasn't easy, particularly with just a small group of volunteer contributors. Arano says they never figured out a good revenue model, and the site typically only took in $200 or $300 a month from Google Ads. The pace and lack of income weren't sustainable.
Literally for 5 years, I did not have a day off or a vacation. You know, even if we went on a trip somewhere, I was still running back to the motel, getting articles set up to go out the next night.
Deciding to resign was a drawn-out process. Arano says even the morning he woke up earlier this week and wrote a Facebook post announcing he'd step down, he was still 50-50 about the decision. The departure is a big deal for close watchers of state and city politics because of the unique role the site filled. While Alaska Commons would sometimes break news, Arano is quick to point out it is not a news site, and even pieces with original reporting departed from traditional journalistic standards for neutrality. Stories would frequently criticize conservative targets and wound up enmeshed at the center of disputes on controversial issues. Some commentators and politicians complained of being unfairly attacked on the site, notably during the 2015 mayoral election and a recent disagreement over whether an assembly member inappropriately suggested there could be a terrorist training camp in the Mat-Su Valley. Arano didn't mind getting criticized for stories, but he hated when people would dismiss the site as just a liberal blog.
That's what really would get under my skin, because I have spent 5 years fighting the charge that I'm not legitimate, that I'm not worth listening to, that I'm easily discreditable.
Arano says he isn't sure what his next steps will be. As for Alaska Commons, a crowdfunding page was set up just before news of Arano's departure. A board member says there'll be a meeting this weekend to discuss options for the site's future. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists in Southeast use remote-controlled kayaks to study melting glaciers.
You can control it with a radio controller or with waypoint navigation. So just clicking on points on a map and it'll go there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Wrangell's only proposed pot business has been given the go-ahead pending the approval of a local building permit. The Wrangell Borough Assembly approved Happy Cannabis for both cultivation and retail on Tuesday. The Marijuana Control Board approved owner Kelsey Martinson's plan earlier this month, but there is some uncertainty whether local residents will be able to buy marijuana. Martinson is weighing the burden of a new excise tax implemented by the borough. Earlier this month, the assembly approved a $10 per ounce excise tax for cultivators and $2 per ounce for plant remains. That's on top of the state's charges, $50 per ounce for marijuana and $15 per ounce for leftovers. Martinson planned to produce about 16 pounds of marijuana per week and estimates the local tax could equate to about $200,000 annually. At that price, Martinson would also be paying the state about $650,000 per year. The assembly also voted to limit the hours of operation for retail shops to between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. Martinson renovated part of his current business, the Diamond Sea Cafe, to house both his cultivation and retail operation. He says it may be hard to compete with the black market because of the taxes he will have to pay. In less than a week, the first cruise ship of the season will dock in Skagway, bringing thousands of visitors to busy Northern Lynn Canal port. But if lawmakers in Washington haven't agreed on a spending plan by then, a government shutdown would close one popular visitor attraction, Skagway's National Park. KHNS's Abby Collins has more.
Congress has until midnight Friday to agree on a budget. If that doesn't happen, funding will expire and the federal government will shut down. That means many federal departments and employees would have to close their doors and stop working, including Alaska's national parks. Last year, the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park in Skagway welcomed nearly a million visitors. It's the most visited park in Alaska. Superintendent Mike Trunell says they're currently ramping up operations for this summer season. But if the government shuts down, the flood of visitors coming into town will have to find something else to do. The Park Service follows a contingency plan laid out by the Department of the Interior.
If the government shuts down the buildings that any of the public buildings are closed and any of the offices and maintenance buildings, everything is closed and locked and not available to the public.
The Klondike Park is a major piece of Skagway's downtown visitor industry. It operates a number of museums, along with guided tours that attract hundreds of people on busy cruise ship days. It also oversees the U.S. side of the popular Chilkoot Trail. Trunell says in the event of a shutdown, most local employees would be furloughed.
We're close to our full staffing for the summer season, which is around 60 employees, 30 permanent and term employees, and then 30 additional seasonal or summer-only employees. So all of those would be affected except for two.
At the peak of the summer season, the Park Service employs around 1,100 employees statewide. This isn't an unprecedented situation. The last time the government shut down was in 2013. But there is one big difference. That happened in October, after the tourism season had died down.
So it wasn't during the peak of the tourism season, but we had a couple staff members who were just checking on security of buildings and things like that, and everyone else gets furlough notices, whether they're a permanent employee, seasonal employee, or term employee.
It's hard to imagine a worse time of year for the park to face a potential closure. Skagway is on the cusp of an expected 1 million visitor season. The first cruise ship docks on May 2nd, bringing just over 2,000 visitors to town. Two other ships will arrive later in the week. The first four-ship day is the following week, on May 9th. Trunell says he hopes the park will be operating normally when the visitors arrive.
The Department of the Interior, which the National Park Service is part of, is hopeful that Congress will pass a continuing resolution or a budget and that there won't be a government shutdown. So we've been instructed to continue business as usual and to not invest a lot of time and effort in contingency planning for a shutdown.
Fears of a shutdown were alleviated somewhat on Monday when President Trump indicated he may be able to wait on federal funding for a border wall. But Congress still needs to come to an agreement on the rest of the budget. This isn't the first time in recent months that federal politics have led to uncertainty for Alaska National Parks. In February, parks worried a federal hiring freeze would stop essential seasonal employment. After a couple weeks in limbo, they were able to hire summer staff. In Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
A company looking to bring a football field-sized airship to Alaska is planning to use it to transport liquefied natural gas to the state's rural areas. PRL Logistics first announced plans to base an airship at its facility along the Kenai River last year. Founder and CEO of the Anchorage-based transportation and contracting company, Ron Hyde, updated the Kenai City Council on the project last week. The egg-shaped aircraft is expected to be ready for use in 2019. Plans also include building a $10 million hangar in Kenai to house the airship. Alaska's mariculture industry is in its infancy compared to other regions of the world. But it has the potential to be much larger, maybe worth as much as $1 billion within three decades. Marco Scheer is a board member of the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation, which published the first phase of a study called the Alaska Mariculture Initiative in 2015. He discussed his organization's hopes for mariculture in front of the Sitka Chamber of Commerce last week. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Scheer's message was straightforward. There's money to be made.
If we developed 1%, 1% of that coastline and utilized it for producing various species, whether it be oysters or mussels or kelp or things like that, then it has the production capacity to exceed the rest of the continental United States.
Scheer stressed the importance of the state's existing infrastructure in ramping up mariculture. Seafood plants are idle during the winter months when the processing of some mariculture products is needed. There is freezing capacity, transportation, and access to markets. Scheer called mariculture the low-hanging fruit of economic opportunity in Alaska. He said that worldwide, the harvest of kelp was a $20 billion industry. He said that the United States supplied only 15% of the 4.4 million tons of oysters farmed each year. The Sitka Chamber was generally receptive, but there were some long memories in the audience. A mariculture permit application in Sitka Sound around two decades ago encountered significant opposition from residents who already used the proposed area for subsistence or recreation. Scheer thought barriers could be removed by cultivating a different product.
Most of the recreational uses of coastal lands in Sound takes place between May and September. I would say the vast majority of that, the tourist industry, all of that. Kelp is put in September and harvested in April. I think in reality, the conflict for that space is going to be pretty minimal, number one. And number two, we're not, you know, relative to the amount of area, we're not talking about covering every coastline with kelp farms.
The state legislature created the system for mariculture leasing in 1988, and Scheer described its status now as a cottage industry. Nevertheless, statewide production topped $1 million in 2014. Scheer cited Oceans Alaska and Hump Island Oysters, two Ketchikan businesses that were both scaling up. He thought the economic climate in Alaska was different now than when Sitkins opposed mariculture in the Sound.
The potential for it as a another economic development opportunity for the state is, for whatever reason, is now much more on the radar. I think it's in no small part because of the realities of the Alaska budget situation, and you've got to look to build opportunities. You know, there isn't a timber industry. I think a lot of the extraction, the resource extraction industries, are having a difficult time due to any number of different reasons. You know, and this is an industry that that is supplemental to what currently exists, and is, you know, frankly, pretty environmentally friendly.
And finally, in case there was any confusion, Scheer emphasized that mariculture was not salmon farming. Commercial fishing is a pillar of our economy and always will be, he said. We don't grow anything with fins. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers graduate programs that deliver a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules to support personal goals. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The novelty of seeing a jumbo squid in Unalaska is not wearing off. A second one washed ashore Monday night. David Tonin of the U.S. Coast Guard was excited to check it out. He says he's never seen anything like it.
You know, I've seen little squid and, you know, squid we use for bait and stuff, and squid at aquariums and when I was diving down in the Caribbean, but nothing that big. I mean, the thing had to have weighed 50 pounds or so, probably more.
This squid is bigger than the last one, which turned up on the beach on April 10th. Tonin is 6 feet tall and estimates this squid is about 10 feet long. At this point, it's unclear if the two dead squids are an unrelated coincidence or if they're a sign of something more significant. LeConte Glacier near Petersburg has been the focus of a lot of research lately. It's the southernmost tidewater glacier in the Northern Hemisphere, and scientists have been studying it to give them a better idea of glacial retreat and sea level rise around the world. There's a lot more planned for May, but to get close to the glacier, which is constantly calving, the team of scientists is relying on unmanned, remote-controlled kayaks. KFSK's Angela Denning has more.
On the flat gravel surface of Petersburg's drive-down dock, two bright yellow plastic kayaks are propped up on makeshift tables. These kayaks don't look like ones that you see around here. They're shorter and wider, and they have a bunch of equipment attached to them. They also have a sciencey name, Robotic Oceanographic Surface Sampler, or ROS for short.
It's actually easier with the pliers to get that.
Leaning into one of the cockpits is June Marion. She's a petite brunette with her hair in a bun and the principal engineer for the project.
And this is a little joystick. It's designed to be driven around by, like, recreational fishermen.
But these kayaks have been completely tweaked by Marion and an ocean robotics team from Oregon State University. Five of those scientists are working here today. They control the kayaks by laptop computer, up to a few miles away. The boats are customized with a keel, antennas, lights, and boxes of computer chips and wires.
We can control it with a radio controller or with waypoint navigation. So just clicking on points on a map and it'll go there, which is pretty cool.
You can even start the engine by a computer, which programmer Jasmine Nahorniak does from a table on the other side of the dock.
Yeah, go ahead.
It sounded to me like a lawnmower.
Yeah. It's a little one-cylinder Subaru Robin engine. It's about 7 horsepower. We go, with all of our instrumentation inside the kayak, about 3 or 4 knots.
If they're not loaded down, they can go about 20 knots, I think.
But these kayaks are packed with high-tech equipment. Fully loaded, they weigh between 300 and 400 pounds.
All of the electronics, all the batteries. This is an electronic fishing reel that we use as a profiling winch.
The profiling winch drops an instrument down into the water using a line running out from a metal A-frame over the top of the kayak.
And then we can let, you know, a couple hundred meters of line go down and the instrument will profile the whole way down. We're taking measurements 6 times a second, I think.
They're looking at things like salinity, temperature, and depth. That's all in the back of the kayak. In the middle, other equipment measures water velocity.
So we use all of that information together to try to understand how the ocean contributes to melting from below, in addition to atmospheric conditions melting glaciers from above.
The robotics team has been spending the last 4 days here at the dock to get the kayak seaworthy. A whole other team of ocean scientists postponed their trip to Petersburg until May because there was too much ice in Lecompte Bay. It's part of a multi-year project to study how fast the glacier is retreating, specifically looking at the cold subglacial discharge sucking in the warmer water from the deep ocean.
Because, I mean, these were fully charged.
I would bet this is probably...
Over at the other kayak, two robotics science students are working on the navigation. They're intensely looking into an orange plastic box full of computer chips and wires.
So I don't even know what to call it. Well, it looks like computer stuff.
Box full of, yeah.
Wires
like,
and...
We call it our electronics box.
Okay.
Easily enough.
That's Nick McComb. He should know what it is. He helped build it.
Basically, everything's fed into here. It's got a whole computer, a bunch of different electronics that work together. It's basically, we took for the autonomy part of it, we took the same chip that goes in a drone. There's a whole bunch of custom stuff we did to it, but it allows it to just drive these boats around completely by themselves.
Right now, the kayaks are programmed to do what the scientists say. That's all that's required for the Lecompte project this spring. But there's always a new technological challenge around the corner. For McComb, that means getting the kayaks to make decisions.
Like, intelligently.
Mm-hmm. For instance, oh, there's an iceberg up ahead. Don't smash into it. Turn left or turn right.
Or also, like, you know, find interesting, like, facets in the water that we want to study and kind of, like, localize on those and kind of find more information but completely by themselves. Just, like, real-time analysis of the data and find the things that are interesting and kind of swarm towards them.
Swarm towards them. That's the future. But for now, the safety net that the kayaks provide is what's important. Glaciers are calving all the time. And right near the surface, that's where the data is that the scientists need.
It's really scary up there, so we send these guys out. And if a big calving event were to happen and an iceberg fell on our kayak, you know, we would hope that we could get it back to get the data back. But, you know, all in all, we lose our instruments and, you know, no life, no human life.
The Lecompte project is funded by the National Science Foundation and the Office of Naval Research. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Abby Collins in Haines, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.